think I'll go ahead and get started. The question I want to ask this morning is, why are there so many people today so reluctant to hear the good news? Have you ever noticed that? I was in Dominican Republic this last week, and the father of the host is an atheist, and I had a chance to talk to him, and I asked him all these questions that we talk about at Southern Evangelical Seminary, the evidence for the existence of God, and he said, well, that's your truth, and I have my truth, and the last thing he said to me, or the last question I asked him, is, I'm just curious, I just have one other question for you, and the question is this: if you could know the truth, would you want to know it? And he said to me, just real frankly, no, I don't want to know the truth. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, what kind of world do we live in today where people don't want to know the truth? I don't know if you're familiar with this statistics, that it's in Stephen Cable's book. If America continues on its current trend, the number of 18 to 29-year-old Americans who state my religious preference is no religion or non-Christian religion will grow to over 50% of the population by 2030. By 2030, half of America will be non-Christian. Do you realize that? And to me, that signifies, to me at least, that what we're doing in terms of evangelism may need to change. And I'd like to suggest that we need a new paradigm, and a new paradigm that combines both apologetics and evangelism. I have a slide here, so I'm just going to read this for you. It used to be we could be confrontational in our approaches in witnessing to people. Can I suggest to you now we need to be more conversational? Used to be we could start with rational arguments. I find today that it's better to start with relational bridges. You think that's true? I used to be a part of Campus Crusade and a lot of ministries that would do monologue presentations, and we present the gospel. Now it seems to me we need to have a dialogue. It used to be that we would use sales tactics in evangelism. Now it needs to be that we need to be a co-traveler with other people. And so I think that this paradigm of how we do evangelism needs to change today. And we have to include apologetics, but we have to be careful how we actually use apologetics in evangelism. Why? Well, I find in my 30 years of ministry experience that people's primary barrier is never intellectual. And if their primary barrier is never intellectual, then just giving them intellectual answers alone is not going to help some people. Would you agree with that? Ephesians 4:18 says they are ignorant. Why? Because of their hardness of heart. And if that's true, then there may be times that we use apologetics, but there may be times that we don't. Or we don't use subjective apologetics. We use other kinds of apologetics. Now, I don't know if you've noticed this, but actually just getting into a conversation with someone, even about politics. Have you noticed how difficult that is today? Now, how do we actually share the gospel with someone and talk about spiritual matters when we can't even talk to our neighbors about politics? Because there's such a division in America today. And so that's why I think to begin and to develop this paradigm, we need to understand the sound barriers in witnessing today. Have you heard this term, the sound barriers in witnessing? Now, the first time I've been taught this terminology was I read something by Keith Davey. Keith Davey is the National Director of Research and Development for Campus Crusade for Christ. And he came up with this term called sound barriers in witnessing. And so let me just read this. There are sound barriers in witnessing today that must be broken before we may open a door for us to see others come to Christ. And it seems to me there are at least four sound barriers in witnessing today. First, we need to move into a conversation, especially with a stranger. Secondly, we need to move a general conversation to a spiritual conversation. And third, we need to move a spiritual conversation to a gospel conversation. And then the fourth is moving a gospel conversation into a decision to receive Jesus Christ. Now, in other words, it's like, it used to be we would just like read a little booklet. Have you noticed that? We just read a little booklet and then they either pray to receive Christ or they're not interested and then we go on to somebody else. What I'd like to suggest is this new paradigm needs to be broken up into many steps. And so we want to talk about each of these different steps, all right? So let's talk about the first step, moving into a spiritual, any conversation, especially with a stranger. I mentioned at the very beginning that Gary Poole has a book called The Complete Book of Questions. And so if you don't know where to begin with a stranger, can I suggest that you buy that book and look at some of the questions and then kind of have in the back of your mind some questions that you can use to move in a spiritual direction. All right? The thing that we need to understand is there are a few things that we need to keep in mind as we engage people in this paradigm. And we break these steps up into four different steps. First of all, we must remember this. We must be good news before we can effectively share the good news. Now, we can share the good news, but what I've discovered is that we have to be good news ourselves as Christians. Let me illustrate this. Is Brian Henson here? Brian Henson is one of our staff members, and he has an atheistic friend, and his name is John. And Brian has been talking to John for over 5 years and answering his questions intellectually. And John doesn't have any more intellectual questions, but he didn't accept Christ. But here's what John has been saying to Brian and myself. He likes to talk to his Christian friends more than his atheistic friends. Isn't that interesting? And then Brian was telling me a little bit about the fact that this guy, John, went to this church and they reached out to him and helped him with some food and different things like that. And so that had an impact on John. And then John, about a half a year ago, asked me if I could help a friend of his. A friend of his is having trouble just kind of surviving. So I found out where she lived, and I found a pastor in the town. I reached out to the pastor. The pastor reached out to a lady in the church. The lady reached out to her, invited her to church, befriended her, helped her in a lot of different ways. And then I got an email from this lady about a month later. And here's what she said to me in her email. She said, "I want you to know that I think I'm on my way to becoming a Christian. Because someone was good news to her." Do you understand what I'm saying? Someone was good news. Now, John found out about this. John found out that his friend had been helped and spiritually, she was moving in a spiritual direction. Now remember, John had been talking about intellectual issues for about 5 years. But about 2 weeks later, when John heard about this, he called me and said he made a decision to become a Christian. So what I'm trying to say is it's not enough sometimes just to give people the evidence. Sometimes we have to live our lives in such a way that it will make a difference. So we have to be good news before we can effectively share the good news. You know, Jesus was considered a friend of tax gatherers and sinners, right? And so we just need to keep this in mind, that before we speak the truth to our neighbors, we also need to live the truth, right? I call this in our book, Conversational Evangelism, we need to balance what's called head bridges and heart bridges. Head bridges are like objective evidence for the faith. Heart bridges are how God has made a difference in our life. And as they see our lives, that's going to make a difference in their life as well. So the first point is start a conversation with anyone. And last week I was in Dominican Republic and I was flying back and I sat next to a guy next to me, and I always look for divine appointments. So I was trying to talk to him and I was trying to think of all kinds of conversations, and it's kind of awkward. Have you ever been in a situation like that? And finally I found something and we started talking, but it didn't lead anywhere. And it doesn't always lead somewhere. But I'm saying this, there is a barrier when you just even get into a conversation with a stranger. Now, the second barrier is when you move from a general conversation to a spiritual conversation. Have you ever noticed how difficult that is at times? Okay, so let me tell you a story. I told you I was in Dominican Republic last week. And my driver asked me this question. Did you hear what happened in Vegas? I said, yes, that was so tragic. And the moment that I said this, I realized I had an opportunity to move the conversation in a spiritual direction. Now, let me ask you, would you know how to do that? Just by the driver saying, did you hear about what happened? And then my response was, yeah, that's very tragic. So then here's my next question. Do you ever wonder how people like that can do so much evil? Or do you ever wonder what's the source of that kind of evil? Now, he didn't speak very good English. And so through Google Translate, he finally understood me. And I found out this guy was an evangelical Christian for 25 years. But you see, I wouldn't have known this unless I did what? Kind of move the conversation into. This is part of the new paradigm that I think that you and I are going to have to learn, that's different than what we learned growing up. What I learned growing up is I just read a little booklet and I have people who pray to receive Christ. I'm saying that doing evangelism today is going to take more work, more effort, more preparation on your part to actually help take those steps. Now, here's a few things I want you to keep in mind, all right, as we talk about building bridges with people, moving from general to the spiritual. We want to build spiritual bridges from the standpoint of their interests and not our own. Have you learned that yet? In other words, when I'm talking to someone, I don't try to get them to come to church or tell them to listen to my perspective. I find out what they're interested in and then relate the gospel to their interest. So in my cul-de-sac, I know that the fathers on my street care about their jobs. They care about their kids. Some of them care about their lawns. So those are the things I talk about. And then over a period of time, I wait for them to be a little more spiritually open. And then once I sense they're a little more open, then I begin a dialogue. I think I mentioned last year that one of my neighbors asked me this question. Why do smart people not believe in God? What am I supposed to say? Now, I can tell you now, since then, he now lets me pray for him. Why? Because I was sensitive to where he was at, what his interest was, and then building the gospel from his interest. So we can ask questions about family. We can ask questions about their job, politics, or hobbies, movies, sports, or some kind of connection. And the some kind of connections are the kind of divine appointments. Like last week when I was in Dominican Republic, the driver asked me the question. I didn't initiate. He asked me. And so sometimes I pray, Lord, give me a divine appointment and make it so clear it's your divine appointment that you have them ask me a question. You ever prayed a prayer like that? And then just see what doors God opens. The second thing I want you to keep in mind is not only build spiritual bridges from the point of their interest, not our own, but as you listen to them, rather than just identify the gaps in their beliefs, which is kind of what SES teaches in terms of the apologetics, right? That we don't start there. That we start by understanding their story. Understand their story. Where are they in their spiritual journey? Where are they? Ecclesiastes 3:11. Solomon wrote this. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Do you understand what I'm saying here? I'm saying that rather than just listening for the sour notes or the gaps in their beliefs, listen to begin to understand where they are in their spiritual journey. And then, if you understand where they are in their spiritual journey, then you can begin to ask questions. Questions about, do you think it's possible we're put here for some kind of purpose? And if so, what do you think that is? And so I use a question like that a lot. Because what it does is, even sometimes with an atheist, I'll ask a question like, do you ever feel like you're here for a purpose? And they'll say to me, yes. But they don't believe in God. But deep down inside, they have a desire for a purpose or a meaning. Or I'll ask a question like this. Is there anything in your life that helps you cope with difficult times? Is there anything in your life that helps you cope with difficult times? By the way, I'll give you all these PowerPoints, all right? So you just have to sign up for them. But I just want to kind of stimulate your thinking a little bit to get beyond the box of evangelism that you've been taught and help you understand some other ideas. Now, then we want to move a spiritual conversation to a gospel conversation. And sometimes this is the hardest part. Have you ever noticed this? We can have some kind of spiritual dialogue with people at work, but when we go to try to share the gospel, it doesn't seem to come. Have you noticed that? It's hard to get to the gospel, even when we talk about, you know, someone's church background or maybe they have an interest in spiritual things. And so that's why our ministry developed what was called the five planks. You're all familiar with that concept? The five planks. I'm accountable. I can't measure up. I'm a sinner. I need an outside source for help. And I need what only Jesus can provide. Now, here's what I've learned. That if I can get someone to admit that they are accountable in some way, it's easier to get them to admit that they're a sinner. Would you agree with that? Let me say that again. If I can get someone to admit that there is a creator that they are accountable to, it's a lot easier to get that person to admit that they're a sinner. Why? Well, because if they're honest, they'll admit that even if they don't believe there's a standard that they have to measure up to according to God, they have a standard that they don't even measure up to themselves. They don't even measure up to their own standard. So if I'm accountable and I don't measure up to my own standard, you see how it might be easier to get them to admit that they're a sinner? If you can get them to admit that they're a sinner, do you see how easier it is to get them to admit that to share the gospel? Now, what's the problem? The problem is getting someone to admit that there is a God. How do you do that? How do you get people to admit that there is a God? How do you get them to admit that there is a God? I find that a lot of objections that people have to God are not philosophical, right? They're personal. But then they say, because of science. They use science. So Don's going to come up and share a little bit. How do we deal with some of these kind of people?
Coming online here in a moment. Yay! Now you're excited till I actually start speaking, and then you'll say, boy, I wish that thing was muted. So what do you do? Has anybody ever come across a objection where somebody says, but science says, or something like that? Well, sure, that's normal. What we're going to talk about today was a few ways to get past that, how you don't get just stuck at one point where they say something and you think, do I really need to study 4 years of biology to answer this person? Or is there another way we can do it just based on the conversational evangelism method? And I think you'll find this would be really helpful. The key is they're going to position themselves as the authority. I know this science, you're an ignorant Christian, and you should just give in and accept what I have to say because you don't know science. And the truth is, most people on earth don't know science, much less Christians, so that's not a big deal. So what we're going to do is we're going to find ways to penetrate past that, because that's not a real objection. The majority of time, that's a shield they put up simply to keep you from penetrating to their hearts, which is where the problem is. The problem's here, it's not here. They can come up with stuff to block you, but they think, if I put this up, I've learned to put this up, and then Christians quit poking me here, and I can stay away from that sensitive side. So I want you to think, and I think this way, not necessarily step by step, but there's three questions that you should ask yourself each time they bring up this objection. The first question you should ask yourself is, what's the question or issue behind that question or issue that needs to be addressed? And you'll see, we're going to give three examples of doing all these methods, so you're going to see them work. But for now, just the first one is, what's the question or issue behind their question or issue? Because if they say, I believe in science, not God, well, there's something behind that that they believe that's causing the problem. That's more than that. Number two, the second question, what is the truth that we want them to grasp concerning the issue or question raised? Question one, what's the question behind their question? Question two, what do we want them to understand about this situation? And question three, or step three, is what are some questions, illustrations, or stories we can use to move them past that barrier and closer to the cross? You see how this works? Analyze what their problem is, analyze how we get past that, and analyze how we move them towards the cross. It's just a three-step process. You can put all the fancy verbiage you want on it, but it's just basically that, which is analyzing why they put this shield up here, how to get past it, move them closer to the cross. That's exactly what we want to do with evangelism. Am I right about that? Yeah. Objection number one. You're talking to the person and you say, well, Christ died for our sins. And they say, well, I believe in science, not religion. Has anybody ever come across that one? I know I have, and you hear it all the time. It's a very common one on television, especially because they think this one has the be-all, end-all stumpers. So what's the question or issue behind the question? Well, the first question or issue is, when they say, I don't believe in religion, what are they thinking of as religion? What image do they have? Do they have in mind an image of a religion as simply a way to grow closer to God, that with whom you already have a personal relationship? Is that what they're thinking about? Now, typically what they're thinking is, they when they think of religion, they're thinking of a system that has these moral precepts and all this list of rules you have to follow from God that control your thoughts and actions. They're thinking in terms of religion is a rule book that guides your thinking and everything in your life. Now, for people in this room, is that how you view religion? Do you view the Bible as a set of rules you have to follow? No, but that's typically what they think. Why? Because they've never been a believer, so they don't know. The problem isn't that they're necessarily being mean-hearted about the whole thing. The problem is they simply don't know. So when they say believe in science, not religion, typically what they mean by religion is not what we mean by religion. And number two, the second issue or question behind it is a philosophy known as scientism. Not scientist, not science, but scientism, and certainly not Scientology, but scientism. Have you guys heard that term before? Scientism is a philosophical belief. It's a belief about how the world works that says the only real knowledge is scientific knowledge, that everything else is not knowledge, that unless it can be proven scientifically, it's just a bunch of opinions or feelings or emotions. And so if that's the case, where does faith in God fit? Can you show scientifically through physics or any other thing, science, can you show that you have a relationship with God that way? So they believe in scientism. They believe in this belief. They have this naive belief, and I'll say it clearly, it's naive. A naive belief that science is the only way to know anything. So that's the barriers we're working with. That's how you analyze that. You ask, what are the questions and issues behind it? So what's the truth we want them to grasp, want them to understand? Well, if they misunderstand religion that way, then don't we want them to have a better understanding of what religion is from our perspective? So that way they understand that religion, when you properly understand how it is, how it works, has nothing to do with science. It's not anti-science. And in many cases, it's pro-science. Where did science start? Did it start in China, the scientific revolution? Did it start in China? Did it start in India? Started in Europe? Why Europe? Because of the Judeo-Christian tradition that says God created this universe and everything in it, and we are made in His image and likeness, and we can think His thoughts after Him. That is, you take things apart to see how He did it. That's how science began in that environment. Why not India or China? Well, if everything is God, then why would you take it apart? Because it's just how God works. You don't think His thoughts after Him because He doesn't have thoughts. He's just living through everything. And so it started in Europe because of the Judeo-Christian worldview. So religion and science from a Christian perspective are clearly not at odds. And number two, scientism is self-refuting. We want them to understand that. What do I mean by that? Everybody heard the term self-refuting? It just means that if you ask, it says, here's the standard of how to know things. And then you say, does that come from your standard? So if they say science is the only way to know things, did they find that out through a scientific experiment? Did physics teach them that only science is? Did physics teach them that science is the only way to know things? Did biology? Did mathematics? No, it's the idea is to get them to recognize that it's a philosophy they're following that's wrong and empty, not science itself. Scientism, it's their faith in scientism that's a problem. It's self-refuting. It refutes itself because if everything you know is through science and you didn't learn that through science, then it's not knowledge. They've just refuted themselves. So what are some questions, some illustrations or stories we could use that help move them away from, they're over here, here's the cross. What can we do to help move them at least an inch closer, maybe a yard closer? Who knows how it works out in a conversation? Well, you can say things like, in this case, they say, I believe in science, not religion. We could ask them, can you please tell me what you mean when you say science? Because typically, they don't know what science is. Science works by examining things and making hypotheses, testing those things, and then seeing if that's correct or not. They typically won't know that. Not only that, but science works through a system of logic called inductive reasoning. I'm going to get to that in a little while, but we're going to understand why that's a major problem for this, the thing they say. They say, I believe in science, not religion. And they're saying, you either believe in science or religion, right? So we ask them, first we could ask them, what do you mean by science when you say science? And understand, we're not talking about challenging them and aggressively fighting them. We're not trying to defeat them. We're trying to win them to Christ. And so you're doing this in a non-aggressive way. You're just trying to understand their perspective. And so you say, well, I'm not really clear on this. When you say science, what do you mean when you say science? You see how different that is than just saying, well, what do you mean when you say science? It's a difference in our perspective. 1 Peter 3:15 says, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you with gentleness and respect. And that's the key to me for apologetics. You could also say to them, they say, I believe in science, not religion. You could say, well, what would you say to all the scientists who are believers? Are there scientists who are believers? There's entire scientific affiliations of scientists of who are believers. This is not just in general, scientists believe in God less than average Americans. Why is that? Because they're living their lives looking at the physical world, and they're not looking at their life. They're not examining how life is. They're just focused on these tiny physical things. You're not going to find God, well, you can, but you're not going to typically find God if you spend your whole life looking at plastic. So what would you say to the many scientists or believers? Or how about this one? Does anybody know what Albert Einstein? Anybody ever heard of Albert Einstein? He was famous a few years ago. What did he say about science and religion? You guys know? He said, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. He's saying you need both. So the question is, does your friend, neighbor, or co-worker, do they know more than Albert Einstein? Probably not. Objection two, evolution has made belief in God unnecessary. I see a head shaking, but how can we use these tools not to argue with them? Because it's natural when you hear nonsense. It's natural to your back to get a little stiff, to kind of step up and want to say, no. It's natural to want to fight back when somebody comes at you aggressively. That's just how we're made. The key is, can you rely on the calming influence of the Holy Spirit to stand back and understand, this person is not my enemy. My enemies are powers and principalities. This person is a tool of that power and principality. I want to help him or her to make it to heaven. They're not my enemy, so how can I help win them? So they say evolution has made belief in God unnecessary. So what's the question or issue behind the issue or behind the question? Well, how about this? What they're saying is, I don't need to believe in God because evolution has explained all of life. Isn't that kind of what they're getting at? That if evolution explains everything in life, then where does God fit in? Is he, where do you put it? Do you put him in this slot here? You got this whole edifice of how life came to be, and there's a crack, and we slide God in here? That's what he's asking. They think that you become a Christian, that you instantly have to stop thinking about science. They're saying, if they say, I believe in evolution has made belief in God unnecessary, what they're saying subtly is that if I become a Christian, I have to stop believing in science. They're making their enemies. So, what are the questions, issues behind the question? Well, they believe in evolution as a blind, unguided process. This is the truth of what they believe. And they recognize that that is incompatible with God's creation and supervision of the universe and life within it. Does that make sense? If evolution just happens, then you have no need for God. If simple random matter in motion, the accidental co-location of atoms equals life, and everything happens without any sort of supervening intelligence, no sort of planning, etc., well then, of course, you don't need God if that's true. But does evolution explain everything? What is the truth we want them to understand? Well, there's a lot evolution can't explain, never can, never could, never tried to. Can evolution tell you why you love somebody? For a person who's a convinced materialist, they believe everything's just matter and energy, and they believe evolution explains all life. For them, love is a biochemical illusion programmed into us through our genetic code to get us to reproduce, to keep the genes moving along. That's all it can be. It can't be something spiritual and deep, because if you're a materialist, there is no spiritual. And so they have to explain love in terms of simple physical processes, The woman smells certain things in the man's odor that indicates he'll make a good match and their DNA is compatible. His brain starts whirling around. He's visually based and these chemicals start releasing and boom, before you know it, they're making children. And that's all there is. That is an evolutionary explanation of love. It's simply a process, an illusion that happens within our brains that causes us to reproduce. Do you think that evolutionists don't love their children? Do you think they don't love their spouses? Of course they do. But what happens is they have to put that in a separate category. I know this is what love is from my science. This is what I feel love is. And they have to keep them separated. It's called cognitive dissonance, if you want to get fancy. But all it means is they got two ideas that are contradictory. They keep separated in their brain. Well, many times, most of the time, they're completely unaware of this. They never even thought about it. For them, the discipline of science is what I'm studying, and I'm not applying it to my life. Sometimes we can help them with that. Well, even if evolution is true, it still doesn't eliminate God, because if evolution can explain how every atom, every molecule, every amino acid, every bit of the biological machinery got together, there's something else missing there. If I show you what do you know? It's up there. I didn't realize it was working. Are you guys doing that following? Is that what you're doing, Raymond? Oh, thank you. If there's a beautiful painting up here and scientists study it, they can tell you every type of chemical used to make it. They can tell you what brush strokes resulted in this sort of appearance on the painting. They can tell you all that. Can science tell you why the painting was made? Can science tell you how you respond to that painting, how you feel about it? Can science tell you what made it beautiful? No. So science doesn't explain everything. Evolution can't explain that. That's just simply a different category. Even if evolution was true, and I could give you 50 examples of this. You go to have a discussion with your neighbor who's an unbeliever, and they start bringing up abortion or whatever else. Does science tell them that abortion is good or bad? No, science doesn't. It's neutral. Scientists can study what societies hold are good or bad, or believe are good or bad, but it cannot tell you what actually is good or bad, because those are moral categories, and there are no moral categories in science. What I'm trying to help you understand is, when you're dealing with these people who think science has trumped religion, is how blind they are to what makes their lives, gives their lives meaning and value. And that's where we're trying to get past these. They put these shield up. We're getting past the shield and getting to their heart by asking these sorts of questions and bringing these things up. So how do we help move this person closer to the cross? You could ask, have you ever wondered how the massive amount of information got into DNA? How long is the human genome? Does anybody know? It's in the billions of bits of information. Bill Gates said it's like a computer program, but infinitely more complex than any computer program ever invented. We're supposed to believe that just these molecules ran into each other and then it happened. You could take, how efficient is DNA at storing information? A teaspoon of DNA could store the information for every species that ever existed and every book that ever was written could fit into a teaspoon of DNA. Scientists could perhaps, and they have no idea how DNA can start. Why? Because it's a deoxyribonucleic acid. The ribose is a sugar. Have you ever put sugar in water? What does it do? So what happens if you have DNA floating in an ocean? It dissolves because it's got a sugar backbone. So how do you get DNA to form without outside of a cell? Answer is you can't. So they get this huge problem of how that, but not only that, not only the physical problems, but even if they could overcome that, the information. If I hold up a book, you could look at it and say, well, the paper is made of a certain type of, fiber from trees, there's ink is from squids or whatever. You could analyze the components, but there's something else there. There's the information that makes up the book. Where does that come from? It comes from a mind, doesn't it? How about DNA? It's infinitely more complex than any book ever written. And yet, it's not supposed to have risen from a mind. Can you imagine the entire set of Encyclopedia Britannica being found in a field and having somebody tell you, oh, that just happened? Well, that's what they're asking us to believe about the origin of life. You could say, did you know that there are agnostics and atheists that doubt whether evolution can account for much of our experiences? I've already mentioned justice, love. There's a million examples of this. Everything that makes your life have meaning does not come from a materialistic background. They want to vote and they want to change our society in a certain way. Do they know scientifically that that's going to result in a better society? No. But they feel it in their heart. Well, how can they explain their heart scientifically? So people using scientific objections have simply not thought about what makes their lives worth living. An example is a philosopher from one of the state universities in New York named Thomas Nagel wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. Has anybody read that? It's actually almost readable for a philosopher's book. He is an atheist. He does not believe in God at all. What is his book, Mind and Cosmos, about as an atheist? The subtitle is, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. That is, he's sure that the Darwinian evolution is false because it doesn't explain things like I just explained and other things. Can science can study my brain, can study the chemical reactions, the electrical stimulations, the neurons firing, all that stuff. They cannot tell me what it feels like the first time I kiss my wife. Only I know that. People have experienced similar things, perhaps, but you can't go into my mind and know exactly what I experienced. There are things science can't touch and never, not only haven't touched, but can't touch ever. Objection number three, someday science will have the answers to all the questions that we now can't answer. Someday science will have the questions. So what's the problem behind that? The idea that science can answer all questions. They have faith that science will progress to complete knowledge of the universe and everything in it. If they say, yeah, we can't answer it now, but someday science will. So what do we want them to understand? That their faith isn't in science, it's in materialism, the belief that there's no God. That's what they're focusing on, is not the science side, because science is neutral when it comes to the existence of God. And I would argue, has strongly favors the existence of God. And that's a completely different talk. And that we want them to understand a universe with God has greater explanatory power than one that's only matter in motion. For the same reason we just talked about before with justice, love, all those things. Here's a question we could ask them. What's the problem? What's behind the question? What's the problem? And how do we move them closer to the cross? Well, here's the question or illustration that helps them move closer to the cross. You could ask them, do you believe that science will able to tell me why I shouldn't lie or cheat? Because now we're getting them. Remember I talked about how your life can't be examined 100% through science. Parts can, but most are a lot, but not even half. But anyway, a lot of your life is completely outside of science. Why? Because science studies the material world. There are things that are not material. 2 + 2 = 4, is that correct? Where does it equal 4? Everywhere. Is there anywhere it doesn't equal 4? Okay. Well, Washington. Okay, so 2 + 2 = 4 everywhere. Show me where 2 + 2 = 4. You said it's everywhere. Show me where that's at. Show me where 2 + 2 = 4. That was the symbol for 2 and a symbol for 2. Why am I bringing this up? I see one finger. Why am I bringing this up? Because there's some things that aren't physical and aren't located within physical space. 2 + 2 = 4 is true everywhere at all times and all places, and yet it's not physically located in any specific spot. Can you think of how this might apply for trying to explain why they can't test where God is? Because they want to test where God is. Because God is a different category than all the things you can see, feel, and touch. He's a different category of existence. How does this get back to what we're talking about? Science can only test what you can see, feel, or touch. You can't test what you can't test. You can't test physically 2 + 2 = 4. You can't test God physically because he's not a physical being. The ancients when they described God in terms of spirituality, didn't do it to get away from science. It wasn't a dodge to hide from modern science, because there was no modern science. And you could finally, this is the one I've hinted at earlier, you could ask them, have you heard of the problem of induction? The problem of induction works like this. Science works by examining things. I look out and I go look at swans. I examine 25 swans, they're white. What's my hypothesis? All swans are white. I examine 500 swans, they're all white. What's my hypothesis? All swans are white. Now, does my confidence go up the more I examine? So you might have a 70% confidence after the first study. As you increase it, you might get up to 85%. Can you ever reach 100% confidence that way? What happens the first time you run into a black swan? Your hypothesis is shot. Unless you know the position of everything in the universe at all times, you can never have 100% confidence that an inductive study will result. It's always a percentage. We like to think of Einstein, brilliant scientist. General theory of relativity has been proven out to 19 decimal places to be correct. But it can't be proven 100% because you can't measure everything at all times. Science does things inductively. Deductive logic, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's 100%. The answer is necessary. Science works through induction, which gives you a percentage of confidence. Science is always what they call corrigible. It always is able to change because it's never certain. So when they say science will have all the answers, it means they don't understand what science is. That's what I'm getting at, is that these objections, they may be tricky because you're not used to thinking this way, but I'm saying they're not that hard to overcome once you understand the issues behind it. And then if you think about it for a while, then you can start coming up with your own questions and illustrations that will help them recognize where their thinking is wrong, and then the ways to get them to move one step closer to the cross, which is our whole purpose. And you could say, did you realize that even agnostics realize that there are limits to science? David Berlinski is an agnostic. He doesn't know if God exists. I don't know that he particularly cares about it. He wrote a book called The Devil's Delusion. And the subtitle of that book is Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. What he's saying is, as a person who doesn't know if God exists or not, I can tell you that science has nothing to say on the issue. That's all he's saying. He's a brilliant philosopher and mathematician, and he says it doesn't work that way. Exactly what I've been telling you is what these people who are on the other side, not believers, say. It just doesn't work. David?
All right. Thanks, Don. Isn't that great? You see why I bring him along wherever I go? So let's review what we've talked about so far. We said that in this new paradigm, we want to look at basically their four sound barriers in witnessing today. What was the first sound barrier? Does anybody remember? Without looking at your notes? Just getting into a conversation with someone, right? Any conversation, okay? Especially with strangers. Then the second barrier is what? Moving from general conversation to a spiritual. And what did I say we need to do? Well, ask God for divine appointment. Ask God to bring someone in your life. Ask Him to have them ask you a question if you're timid. And then look for opportunities to move in a spiritual direction. And the book that I passed out for you to read but not to take by Gary Poole, he has some excellent suggestions how to move conversations in a spiritual direction. Then once we move the conversation in a spiritual direction, then we need to move into a what? Gospel conversation. And I said, what is the problem getting in a gospel conversation? That a lot of people won't even accept the idea that we are accountable to our Creator in any way. And so therefore, they don't see themselves as sinners. And if they don't see themselves as sinners, why should they listen to what you have to say about Jesus and how you need Jesus? They're not really open to that gospel conversation. And they're especially not open because of their scientific perspective, right? Then once we have a gospel conversation, what's the last step? A decision to accept Christ. Now, here's what I've learned when you get someone to a decision to accept Christ. Here's what I've learned, the misconceptions that people have. I remember one day talking to a college student on a college campus in the U.S. And here's what he said to me. He said, David, I know everything you're saying to me is true. I just got some things in my life and I want to give up. So here's the misunderstanding that he had. He had this understanding that he had to clean up his life and then come to Christ. And what I told him is that that's not the way it works when we accept Christ. We make the decision to turn around 180 degrees, invite Christ to come into our life, and ask Him to change us from the inside out. And I said to him, you cannot change your life. You cannot stop those bad habits. Okay? But what does Philippians 2:13 say? God is at work in us, but both to will and work His good pleasure, to give us the desire, and then the ability to carry it out. And when we're talking to people, when we're inviting them to make a decision, this is a misconception that a lot of non-believers have, and so we have to clarify that misconception. Remember what Don was saying? What's the question or issue behind the question? So when people have barriers to actually making the decision for Christ, start there. Find out if they have that kind of misconception. And so the next question that I ask people is something like this. What is keeping you right now from putting your faith and trust in Jesus Christ? I remember teaching this a number of years ago in my seminary class, and a student applied that principle to one of her friends that she's been talking to. And her friend, after she asked that question, her friend realized there was nothing keeping her. And right there and then, that friend prayed to receive Christ. So sometimes, if we're talking to people over a period of time, sometimes we just need to ask the question, what's keeping you right now from putting your faith and trust in Jesus Christ? Now, let me try to put the whole picture together for you, based on everything we've been talking about today. Remember the driver in Dominican Republic I talked to last week? And my last question to him was, do you remember? You know, how can someone do that kind of evil? Or what's the source of that kind of evil? Here's my next question if he wasn't a believer. Do you think it's possible that what it says in the Bible about mankind, that could be true or not? Do you think that's possible? And then my follow-up question is, you know, do you realize our problem is not just that we're all capable of committing this kind of evil that man did in Las Vegas? Our problem is greater than that. Our problem is that no matter how much good we do, now you fill in the blank, it's never going to be enough to get off the hook with our Creator. You see what I'm doing? I'm moving to the gospel. And then what's my next question? Do you realize that we are all accountable to our Creator in some way? If we're accountable, I don't measure up, I'm a sinner, I need an outside source for help, and I need what only Jesus can provide. You see how I could just have gone all the way to the gospel just because he asked me a question. Did you hear about what happened in Vegas yesterday? So can I suggest to you that you look for those kind of opportunities every day? It's going beyond your evangelism paradigms that you and I were taught. But if we're going to be effective with people today, and we are going to reach more and more people for Christ, and so in 2030, it won't just be half of Americans are Christians or call themselves Christians. There'll be more. We have to take those steps now. Amen? Okay, Don, come up for a few minutes. We've got just a few minutes. Do we have a microphone? We want to give you a chance to ask any questions, anything that we've been talking about this morning. We just have a few minutes. So who has the microphone? Okay. Which one? Conversational evangelism? It's on the table. Norm Geisler, International Ministries. Yeah. Anyone have a question?
I like that question.
Yeah. Just a few questions. Ask him all the hard questions, though, okay? All the scientific ones. Turn Don's back on as well.
Hello? Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Am I on? I don't think this is on.
I think he's turning.
I'll shout if it doesn't.
Go ahead.
Be interested in your response to a person who says science has got to be true, like evolution, because it's believed by everybody now. You know, it's in all the books.
Sure.
All the educational TV videos.
It's called an appeal to popularity. It's a logical, informal fallacy. What you could ask them is, when everyone believed so-and-so, did that make it true?
Like slavery.
It's simply that. It's just
like
it's,
when we all believed slavery, does that mean that slavery is a good thing? Yeah. Just because a majority believes something, does it make it true? That's the question I would have asked.
And here's how I like to shift that, too, if I may.
Sure.
If the majority believe that the racial situation was good in the 1950s, if the majority of Americans believe that, do you believe Martin Luther King was immoral for his activities because he went against the majority?
Yeah.
Clearly, they're not going to say no.
Right. Right.
And so they're stuck either affirming that majorities don't rule or that that MLK Jr. was
okay,
right.
One more question, then we need to wrap this up. Yes, right here.
So when someone makes like a scientific claim, we know that these people put crazy resources like blogs and YouTube to get their information. I know there's evidence-based research.
Right.
Like how, I guess for us, how can we get those information to validate, even ask, like, where'd you get that information at? And
right.
How do, you know, like, what's some good resources?
To validate which things?
The like, I guess more like cosmology and just questions.
I would
that
say,
are going there.
Depending on your perspective, if you're a young earth creationist, then Institute of Creation Research or Creation Ministries International. I'm an old earth creationist, and so I'm a member of
Hugh Ross's.
Hugh Ross's Reasons to Believe, of which.
Yeah.
I see Ken Samples back there.
Yeah.
So if you want a young earth answer, you go to the CRI or Creation Ministries. If you're an old earth, if you lean that way, Reasons to Believe.
All right, let me close in a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for our time together this morning. Lord, I pray for my dear brothers and sisters in Christ. Lord, I pray that you would help them to understand, like the men of Issachar, the times in which we live and know what we should do. Thank you for our time together this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for coming, everyone.